But there's a light on in Chicago. That's Chicago hardcore scene legends, Fall Out Boy. I'm Blake Murphy, and this is Jays Talk Plus. That light flickered back on for the Blue Jays on the South Side on Monday as they topped the league's worst team 5-1. That's the league's worst team that also came into this series with their manager calling them out, with a pitcher going who allowed 9 runs to the Blue Jays last time. You're the Toronto Blue Jays right now. Take them where you can get them. It was not stress-free. The Jays didn't know if Chris Bassitt was going to be able to make his start. He gutted out a neck strain for what I believe is the second time in a row. He didn't mention this post-game that I caught, but the last time we saw him against the White Sox, he had a glove on and was rubbing, I don't know, Voltaren or whatever the equivalent is, on his lat area last start. This time, he said after the game, he wasn't able to turn his head, so he had to change his pitching delivery, still managed to give the Blue Jays 5 shutout innings. Then the bullpen came in. They danced around some trouble of their own. Eric Swanson continues to struggle. Hedesis Cabrera made things interesting with a 4-run lead, but they got out of it to hang on to the 5-1 lead. That 5-1 lead, by the way, that was created by 3 appearances from the home run jacket, including a home run from George Springer in his first at-bat ever hitting 7th or lower in the batting order, another Bo Bichette home run to center field in Chicago, and what was one of probably the premier plate appearances of the season for the Blue Jays, Davis Schneider in the 9th, fighting off a couple of fastballs right on the edge, finally getting a pitch to hit that got a little bit more zone, taking it for a ride for a 2-run home run, 6-pitch at bat where, yeah, he just kept fighting until there was a mistake pitch to jump on, and he did that against John Brebbia, something Davis Schneider has done a pretty good job of this season, a very, very professional at-bat. No, the Toronto Blue Jays are not fixed after 1-5-1 victory against the worst team in the league, but you can only do it 1 at a time. Light back on for now. We'll see if Kevin Gausman can keep it rolling tonight against Mike Clevenger. Don't imagine the vibes have shifted all that much. Let's take a look at where the vibes were Sunday after they dropped 3 in a row to Detroit. And not to be, you know, overly negative the day after a win, but those losses are not very far behind us. Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of Sportsnet.ca, was there in Detroit. Ben, how we doing, man?
Doing great. It was fun to be in Detroit. It's a great ballpark. That city's really on the up and up in the last 10 years or so. So it was a great time down there. And yeah, I mean, the Jays played some really bad baseball, so we can get to that. But the ballpark, the city, that was a good experience.
Yeah, I love the patent diagram of the baseball you have in the background, by the way. That's an excellent Zoom accoutrement there. So yeah, you wrote about it Sunday after the game. The Jays, they won on Thursday. They dropped 3 in a row after that. 2 where they couldn't get the offense going. 1 where they had a big comeback, but then the bullpen let it unravel in a 14-11 loss. And you said it right in your lead of that piece. The Blue Jays are in trouble. They're not in any less trouble one day after beating the worst team in the league. So for anyone who missed that piece, for anyone who somehow missed how fired up everyone was Sunday and Monday morning, where were you at coming out of that Detroit series with this Toronto Blue Jays team?
Man, it's wild because I wrote, as you said, that they're in trouble. I feel like some people wanted me to write that like they're dead, they're never coming back, cancel the franchise. I think they're in trouble. I think they're in real, real trouble. Maybe that's not strong enough. I don't know. We'll see. I think that you just look at the numbers and you look at what they're going to have to do to get anywhere close to 85, 88, 90 wins. They would have to play at a level that's so far beyond anything they've shown this year that it is going to be really, really difficult. And again, you look at the numbers, you look at the playoff odds, 17% right now, even after the win on Monday, that means that there is a 5-6 chance that they are not making the playoffs. So they are very unlikely to make the playoffs at this moment in time. There's a lot of baseball left. And it's interesting though, Blake, because being in there after the game, talking to Bo Bichette, Kevin Biggio, Yusei Kikuchi, John Schneider, you talk to those guys and they were, I'm just relaying what they said, right? They were very encouraged by the comeback. They were very taking a big positive from the fact that they were able to score as many runs as they did. But again, you can't deny the numbers. They are where they are. They are not in a good spot.
They're not. And look, there is, like you said, a lot of baseball left to be played, but you have dug yourself a hole here. You're 24-29, even after that win yesterday. And no, we don't need to look at things like how many games behind you are or teams to jump yet. The playoff odds don't mean all that much. But if we go back to where we were at the start of the season and how many wins we thought would be enough in the American League wildcard race, you probably have to play at something close to a 95 win pace from here. And that is, you know, at the start of the season, that wasn't a complete impossibility, but it was probably closer to like the 90th percentile outcome for what this Blue Jays team could do, maybe even a little higher than that. So you've now put this team in a spot where, hey, we weren't all that optimistic, thought you'd be in like the mid 80s, maybe high 80s. And now we need you to play at a pace that's, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 games better than that for 2/3 of a season here. So it is kind of get busy living or get busy dying time for this team. You mentioned talking to a couple of the guys after the game. What was the mood in that clubhouse? I know you had that great Kevin Biggio quote early in your story about what a good moment the Varsho home run was. Did you get a sense that they were, you know, a little bit conflicted, maybe trying to take some of the positive with how deflating that could have been?
Yeah. And I think that players, it's funny, right? Like, players have a different mindset than fans. That's stating the obvious. But for players, they're in there in that dugout. Dalton Varsho hits this home run. They're taking the lead against the Tigers. That's a big moment for them. Like, that really is. Take nothing away. I think, you know, some of the guys were calling it like a magical moment for that game. But of course, they come back and lose. Matt Vierling gets them, and it erases the positives. Like, it really does. They're in the business of winning baseball games, not having nice moments. And they're not at a point in the season where having nice moments matters that much. I'm sorry to say it. I know it sounds kind of sad, but this is where they are. Having these like encouraging little silver linings is not good enough. But yeah, the players themselves, like, they took some positives from that. You know, Bo Bichette is probably one to veer, you know, maybe closer to fans on this stuff, where he's like, yeah, we've got to win. Like, end of the day, we have to win. That's that. But, you know, other players and John Schneider as well, they were inclined to point to the positives there.
Yeah, which, you know, I completely understand fans not exactly wanting to do that. Yeah. The Jays don't really have a choice, right? And it's interesting to hear their thoughts on that one, especially John Schneider's, because, you know, look, some of what John Schneider says is because he has to talk to us 2 or 3 times a day. That's a lot of air to fill. I know that grind well. But he did, you know, say something pretty interesting on Saturday as well, after the Blue Jays struggled to score for a second game in a row. And you wrote about this at sportsnet.ca as well. And he said he wasn't pointing the finger, and I didn't take it as finger pointing, but he did kind of say, like, these questions keep coming up. And like, at a certain point, like, the players are the ones who are paid to get the job done. What did you make of that? Did that seem like frustration to you from John Schneider? Or did that seem just like him kind of telling like it is?
Well, and just first off, like, I do personally, I think the fans are right on this one. Yeah. And that the Blue Jays are in a bad spot.
Yes, so, they're absolutely right. I have come on consecutive Mondays now and just like, all right, the guest's not coming in for 5-6 minutes here. I need to rant on consecutive Mondays. They're not in a cherry spot here, Ben.
Yeah, they really aren't. So definitely want to acknowledge that. As for Schneider and his comments, yeah, you know, for an old school manager like Jim Leland circa 1996, that's nothing, right? To say, oh, the players need to produce. But keep in mind, this is 2024. It's a different era. Managers speak differently about their players, right? John Schneider is not someone who goes after his players. He has their back. Sometimes, to the frustration of fans, he will have these guys back. So in that context, for him to speak the way he did after Saturday's game and say, look, these guys are paid to produce. At a certain point, it's our job to prepare them. It's their job to produce. That was him saying they're not doing it. And at a certain point, what can you say? They're not doing it. It's the bullpen. It's been the offense. I mean, I know the offense has been a bit more average in May than, you know, horrible the way it was in April. But the bullpen, right, is so exciting. They're average. But the bullpen has been awful. So they still have these problems. It's still not a good baseball team, and they're still in a tough spot in the standings.
And it's a tough one too, because, you know, obviously you win and lose as a team. I spoke to Caleb Joseph yesterday, and he echoed this on Blue Jays Central after that, you know, in his estimation, he's been in clubhouses like this, on teams like this, and it's as much as you want everyone to collectively be together, it's about 26 guys kind of taking ownership of their own work. Like, we know baseball's a team sport, but it's also kind of a collection of individual performances a lot of the time. And that's kind of where he was at. So I do wonder, you know, when Kevin Biggio says, hey, that Varsho home run was a really great moment for us, the offense has been going a little bit more lately. You know, obviously the bullpen didn't come through in that one. Yusei Kikuchi had a poor start. I do wonder if maybe there's an ability at the individual level to compartmentalize it and look and say, hey, look, Vlad and Bo are hitting a lot better lately. Dalton Varsho's rediscovered the power stroke. Biggio's another guy who's chipped in a little bit more. Obviously, they're still not getting nearly enough from the bench and those kind of fringe guys on the roster. But, could you understand them taking a little bit from, even if the fans aren't going to, you know, at least the position players here thinking, okay, we've got a little something brewing here. At least we're picking up our own slack a bit.
Yeah, it's all you can do, right? It's all you can do. They're still professionals. They're still, you know, tasked with winning a baseball game every single night. They're paid a lot of money. They have their careers and reputations and stats at stake still, and they want to win. It's more fun to win than it is to lose for anyone and anything. So they do want to win. It's not a problem of intent. It's a problem of execution. So yeah, they, I think, are probably right to compartmentalize and try to take that next at bat, next pitch focus forward and see where it takes them. It's all they can do, right? With this week against the White Sox and Pirates, maybe you win four of the next five. Maybe you really are in a better spot. And you can get to the point that instead of being, you know, objectively one of the worst teams in the American League to this point in the season, hey, maybe you're closer to 500, but we're a long way from that. They're not there right now. Where they are right now is still in a spot where they have cost themselves more than any other team in baseball, right? You look at the playoff odds, as we do, Blake, no team in baseball has cost themselves more ground in the standings since the beginning of the season.
It's tough, eh? And the AL East is not getting any easier. If you're the Houston Astros and you're in a similar spot record-wise, at least the AL West has been bad, right? Like, the Seattle Mariners are the only team in that division above 500. You've got a path back not just to the wild card spot, but to your own division. The Blue Jays do not have that. The Yankees and Orioles are not going to slide 11, 12 games in the standings the rest of the way, I don't think. So you said something important there, too, which I think is, it's not the way you want to think about these things necessarily in a team sport, but you said the money is a factor, the stats are a factor. The nice thing about baseball is that even if guys say didn't care all that much about the wins, and they do very much, but if they didn't, the things that you would do selfishly still help the ball club, right? Like, if you're like, I need to get my OPS up, I need to get my RBI up, things like that. My next contract, I got to have my ERA lower, I got to have my RBI up, whatever. Those things help the team win. So as long as, individually guys are going in the right direction, the team should follow hypothetically. Yesterday, we got a couple of nice offensive moments, three home runs there. Bo Bichette continues to be pretty hot here. Davis Schneider, that plate appearance in the ninth inning to come up with that insurance home run, that not only tacked on a couple runs and was a great plate appearance, that saved Jimmy Garcia for a day, right? Like you go from a two-run lead where Jimmy Garcia was going to have to come in, and you turn that into a four-run lead where you can risk Genesis Cabrera. What did you make of that Davis Schneider plate appearance? I thought it was a really good sign for him.
100%. And really, to me, it's just in step with what Davis Schneider has done all week, all season, his entire career as a major leaguer. He's so good at, he has a really good plate approach. He doesn't expand unnecessarily, and he puts really good swings on balls and gets them up in the air to see if they can, you know, go off a wall somewhere or over a wall somewhere. And that's happened a lot. I mean, this guy is, I mean, without exaggeration, one of the best draft picks for this front office in its history of 9 years. I think that's pretty clear. He's kind of emerged out of almost nowhere as a huge success story for this team. And it's too bad they don't have more of them. But this is a player who, ever since he debuted last summer, his OPS is right around 900. It's right in the same territory as guys like Bobby Witt Jr., like elite players. This is where Davis Schneider has been as a hitter during that stretch of time.
Great success story there. A guy picked in a round that wouldn't have existed anymore, who was thought so little of in the org a couple years back that he almost walked away because he wasn't playing that much. just bare, like, That is a guy that very easily could have fallen through the cracks. And who knows? It's like, obviously he loves baseball. Maybe he does it through the independent league and gets his way back or something like that. But there is like a good chance that the Davis Schneider story slips through the cracks if he comes along even 2-3 years later with no 28th round, with fewer minor league contract slots and things like that for a team to have. So pretty fun, pretty fortunate the way this one's played out.
Yeah, 100%. And he's an easy player to overlook, right? He's small in stature. and he is not a great defensive player. He is, some would say, a below average defensive player, but he still does some things really well. And what he does well is the most important thing that a position player can do, which is to stay hit. So, and hit for power and do it against the best pitchers in the world. So this is a classic case where you don't want to look at what a player can't do. And, you know, this guy is never going to be a five tool center fielder, clearly, but he can hit. And yeah, that's the most important thing that he offers. And the Jays don't have a lot of guys right now that we would put into that bucket.
Yeah, maybe yesterday's two-hit game with a home run gets George Springer going down in the seventh spot. But for now, it's the top of the order guys who are, they're still, by the way, if they don't score a run in the first inning today, it ties a franchise record that dates back to their expansion season. This would be their 20th game in a row without scoring in the first inning. I know David Schneider's been good. Danny Jansen's been good. Vlad and Bo have been better. For whatever reason, this only the Oakland A's have had a longer stretch of not scoring in the first inning this year. It's maybe Mike Clevenger helps them solve it, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a good bet for trying to get something across the board. I had no idea about that stat. That is wild. But yeah, speaks to an offense that has not been scoring consistently.
Yeah, and thanks to our friend at Sport Radar for confirming that one for me yesterday. It was worse than I thought, as I told them when they gave me the numbers. Okay, so yesterday, David Schneider adds the insurance, George Springer and Bo Bichette also homer. The Jays also put up a one spot because Chris Bassett's able to give them five shutout innings despite dealing with a neck issue. Couldn't turn his head, he said, after the game. He actually said this was really fascinating. That so he was seeing the White Sox for the second time in a row, and because of his neck stiffness, he had to change the openness of his delivery. And he said he actually thought that helped him because the White Sox were seeing kind of a different delivery from him instead of the same guy twice in a row. I know you weren't there to talk to Chris Bassett, but what did you make of that start? And man, do we even want to think about how ugly this gets if Bassett or anyone in this rotation has to hit the IL?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, the thought crossed my mind when you say Kikuchi on Sunday did have to leave after three innings. It was more performance than health. And afterwards, he said he's feeling good physically. But when Kikuchi doesn't strike anyone out, you're kind of like, what's going on here? But yeah, they need those guys. You do not want to have to dip into AAA. This is a rotation that is five deep, not six deep. So, you want to keep them healthy. But as for Chris Bassett, that is the most on-brand thing for Chris Bassett to have to change his delivery and then somehow make that into a positive and somehow find his way to kind of be crafty enough to still execute against big league hitters. I mean, say what you will with the White Sox, they're not good in the context of Major League Baseball, but you still have to get the job done. So yeah, Bassett, to me, talking to him over the last couple of years, getting a sense of how he thinks about these things, how much mental energy goes into everything that he does and how strategic he is. He's probably one of the few pitchers who can kind of wrangle his way through a start when he doesn't actually have movement in his neck because he's able to kind of outthink the opposition in that kind of Zach Greinke way.
Yeah, who needs a neck, right? It's not an important part of pitching or anything athletic. Okay, so Bassett gives them five innings. Terrifically gutty performance. Hopefully he's better next time through. They do have an off day Thursday, so they can, you know, structure the rotation to buy him an extra day of rest where it's necessary there. Nate Pearson gives him two good innings out of the bullpen after that, which was a nice surprise for a guy who probably saw Chad Green with a locker in Chicago and was like, well, this is maybe my last time out. And then Eric Swanson comes in and once again leaves a splitter in a bad part of the zone. Gavin Sheets jumps all over it. Shortly after that, Andrew Vaughn just missed another home run to center field. Eric Swanson back to, what are we looking at? A 9.22 ERA here. Chad Green was back in that room. Bowden Francis has made a couple of rehab appearances. I know that the team would not be like, yeah, we're gonna phantom IL, and they wouldn't say it like that. But could you see a scenario? We had talked through kind of Pearson, Pop, Cabrera as the options to go down. Is there a scenario where they try to find a way for Eric Swanson to work on these issues outside of the major league roster?
That scenario probably exists. At the same time, if I'm not mistaken, it was five scoreless appearances before that for Eric Swanson. So he was getting some momentum. That location is not good. Yeah, you look at his performance all year, though, and it's been way too many of those splitters up in the zone. And yeah, wow. It's, yeah, very hittable pitches, and we've seen that too often from him. I do think that that's been the case for a lot of Blue Jays relievers this year, and it's contributed to their problems. I mean, we talk all the time about the offense, but low-key, the bullpen has been the worst part of the team this year when you think about just where they rank as far as ERA. They're 28th in bullpen ERA in Major League Baseball. That is way, way worse than what you can have for a contending team. It has cost them chances in games that they've needed to keep close. So as far as the moves, I would expect Pearson to be the one to be option for Green. I think that that's probably the most logical, given that Pearson threw 32 pitches in the series opener against the White Sox. But they will need someone for Francis potentially. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. But I would expect they try to give Swanson a couple more chances to work things through after he did have a solid run there of five appearances.
Yeah, you're right. And it had been five scoreless appearances in a row, but those had come down four, up six, down five, down six, down three. They were as low leverage as those appearances get. And look, they still count. There's still five appearances where it was moving in the right direction, but maybe not a lot of a trust there in bigger spots. The other question, you know, in terms of, and I'll let you go here in a minute, but the DH spot continues to be a bit of a conversation. Justin Turner was in a 3-for-44 slump coming into yesterday. Pinch hit, went 0-for-2 again. So quick math, 3-for-46 slump now. He has a 652 OPS. Daniel Vogelbach has a 565 OPS. Are we getting closer to a point where, you know, one of the arguments against calling a guy up from AAA has been, well, there's not enough playing time. You know, do you want to call a guy up to only play one game a week? Between, you know, Springer maybe getting an extra day down a week given his performance, Kiermaier getting an extra day down because of his age and performance, and now Turner and Vogelbach both underperforming on their sides of that kind of pseudo platoon at the DH spot, are we getting close to a spot where you think there would be enough plate appearances to justify at least a Horwitz type who is 26 and you're not as worried about the, you know, the playing time side of it?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Because you look at it and okay, DH for starters, wow, this was an area where the Blue Jays spent a fair amount of resources this offseason, and what a miss so far, right? Justin Turner, numbers not good. Daniel Vogelbach, not good. Joey Votto injured in the minor leagues. So yeah, it has been really 0-for-3. I mean, for a while it looked like Turner was a big success, but the struggles he's had in May have, you know, essentially canceled out what he did in April. And now the Blue Jays are left with objectively, you rank the DH production, it's very much toward the bottom, I think 26th, 27th in Major League Baseball. So what do you do from here? I think that you could make a strong case to call up Spencer Horwitz, even if he's not playing every day, because he's 26 years old and because you need to win now and you need production as soon as you can get it. At the same time, Horwitz doesn't really fit on a roster where you have Turner and Vlad and Vogelbach. So are you willing to give up on someone like a Vogelbach? Doesn't seem that way. The Blue Jays seem to really like him, and he has, to his credit, had better contact in the last week or so. So if you're holding on to Vogelbach, then I think the discussion is, do you bring Aurelvis Martinez up? And at this point, I mean, I'm not opposed to that. I think he's had a couple months to play second base, so I wouldn't rule that out. But I don't think the Jays are there now. So we'll see. But it's an interesting discussion.
Yeah, Aurelvis Martinez, by the way, in addition to, you know, the defensive questions, he's been, you know, they're certainly not sold that his defense at second base is there yet. And he just moved to second base late last year. So that's not not entirely surprising necessarily. He had pretty significantly cooled off over a couple weeks there, had a better week last week, hit a couple of homers, had a multi-hit game in there. But his numbers, you know, those eye-popping numbers from the start of the season have come down a little bit as well. Ben Nicholson-Smith, thank you for taking the time out this morning, buddy. Twice in three shows. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad to join you anytime, Blake, and I'm glad that to hit 2-for-3 for this little stretch here.
All right, Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, of sportsnet.ca. Lots of good stuff from him from the weekend in Detroit. We have a loaded show today. We are going to talk to Michael Balbin of Fangraphs, who actually went to the same high school as David Schneider, and talked to him a couple weeks ago about how he's able to maintain his composure at the plate, especially in big situations. That should be a lot of fun to hear about. We'll talk to Mikey Ahedo, my buddy from Baseball Prospectus, who did a deep dive on Kevin Gausman's struggles to start the year. That piece came right before Gausman's best start of the year, so we'll see what Mikey thinks of Gausman's 10K outing against the Tigers that we had no data for because the power was out. We're also going to talk to former Blue Jays reliever and one of the all-time leaders in saves in Canadian baseball history, John Axford. And then we'll talk to Lindsay Dunn. We'll look at some of these City Connect rumors, have some fun with Yusei Kikuchi and a bunch of other stuff as well. We'll get you ready for tonight's game to 7:40 down in Chicago, Kevin Gausman against Mike Clevenger. But first, Mike Bauman joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Big night last night for the Toronto Blue Jays. 5-1 victory, including an insurance home run from Davis Schneider. So let's go to Voorhees Township, New Jersey. Let's not talk to Davis Schneider, but someone who went to the same high school as Davis Schneider. It's our pal Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. Michael, how's it going, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
I am good. So, I know your area of New Jersey has not produced a boatload of major league talent. How cool has it been for you to kind of follow along with this Davis Schneider story the last 2 years?
It's been a lot of fun. You know, we do produce a decent amount of talent. Mike Trout's from this area. Zach Gallen actually should have gone to my high school, but he went to parochial school. And Davis Schneider is, he has a special place in my heart because he's a man of the people and went to public school. And we're seeing the benefits of that proud Eastern high school education with just a series of clutch hits in a short Blue Jays career.
Absolutely a series of clutch hits. And I know that's something that you talked to him about when the Jays were in Philly a couple weeks ago. I take small issue with your headline. I must ask you how you're doing this, but I know that's part of the gimmick for you. What was it like catching up with him a little bit and picking his brain on some of his early success here?
He's a fun guy to talk to. That is something that the ball players from around here, I guess with Trout being the exception, they tend to be very thoughtful and introspective people. And Davis is, he was a lot of fun to talk to. He's seems like a decent dude. So, very open about his journey to the majors and what makes him tick. And, I'm really happy he's having that much success.
Okay. So when we dig into what is driving this success, sometimes we can oversimplify a little bit. Well, pull the ball in the air and good things happen. He is maybe, short of Danny Jansen, the best example of that on the Blue Jays. He's got a little kind of Isak Paredes to him where maybe it's not the most elite exit velocity every time. Maybe it's not the farthest hit home run, but he does do a good job pulling the ball in the air. Is that kind of the core thing you think that's gone into his ability to get to this level?
I think so. I think that's the biggest thing. You just look at him. He's short, but he's very, very strong. Like, he was wearing a muscle shirt when I talked to him, and this kid is yoked. So you can see where that power comes from. The pulling the ball in the air, you mentioned Isak Paredes. It's sort of baseball's equivalent of the corner three, where you realize that, wait, the fence is a lot closer down the foul lines than it is to center field. So if you hit the ball in the air down the foul lines, you're going to hit a lot more home runs. And that's really the secret of Davis Schneider's game. And I think there's a ceiling to how good that kind of hitter can be. But, I think that everybody from Davis to everybody in the Blue Jays organization would take the production that he's had, in his first year or so in the major leagues, if that's what it's going to be going forward. And it's interesting because it's in such stark contrast to the rest of the Blue Jays with, Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Before that, Lourdes Gurriel, the guys who made this team one of my favorite teams in baseball to watch. They were very aggressive, all fields line drive hitters. And that's not a great way to get a whole lot of home runs for your exit velocity. But Davis is sold out for this one thing. He's sort of, I know you're a basketball guy. He's PJ Tuckering it. So it's a lot of fun to watch. I'm really happy for his success.
Yeah, it's been cool. You also had an interesting note in that article with him, and you were kind of, I think, trying to get at, how are you able to do this in big situations too? And something that kind of came out of that is he said, well, I'm nervous all the time when I go up there. So like, what's the difference in a big spot? And I thought that was fascinating where, how clutch isn't a thing necessarily, like statistically proven. David Ortiz had clutch. Damian Lillard has clutch. But for the large part of the population, we can't really show that. But if we did, I wonder if maybe that is the key to it, is it's not necessarily that you're just calm in those spots. That obviously would help. But it's how anxious you are relative to your baseline level of anxiety. Maybe we need to dig in a little further on this psychologically. What do you think?
I think that's true. And I believe there's like actual psychological research on this, but I noticed that, you know, in my own life, I have a lot of baseline anxiety, but when there, you know, when something, you know, big happens, I find that I'm much cooler headed than everybody else around me. It's just because, you know, if you're operating at sort of a 9 level of anxiety all the time, there's nowhere to go. So, you know, you just sort of feel the same. In Philly, there's a very, let's say a fascination with guys who they talk about having a slow heartbeat. Ranger Suarez is the guy who you know, has that sort of preternatural calm and cool on the mound. He never seems like he's sweating. And I think that guys like that can be cool in the clutch because they just, you know, don't get up for anything. But if you're going to have another kind of player as a clutch performer, you want the guy who just is just comfortable, you know, being where, you know, in that sort of heightened state of anxiety. So I think that that definitely works for him. It was fun to hear him talk about that, you know, kind of frankly.
And now he's leading off. He's got to start off every game, which I'm sure is, you know, certainly not the type of role he envisioned in the major leagues. And no. That's a whole new set of anxieties there. So he is in that leadoff spot because the Blue Jays have been off to a weird start offensively. George Springer now down in the 7 hole yesterday. Danny Jansen's a 2-hitter sometimes. High level, Michael, what do you make of this Blue Jays start here?
It's, you know, I was going through some of the numbers and it seems like they've got a few guys who are hitting really well, you know, Vlad and Davis Schneider. I'd say Dalton Varsho, I think you have to be pleased with how he's hitting so far. And the rest of the team has really struggled. Like, this team is not going to win if, you know, Alejandro Kirk is slugging under 300, for instance, just to, you know, not to single him out, but that's I think a good bellwether. The rotation has been fine. It hasn't been spectacular. Maybe you want a little bit more out of it. And so if you look at a lineup that has a few really good hitters and a few kind of mediocre hitters and an okay rotation, that's about a 500 team. And you look at how bad the bullpen's been. I put together some numbers. They're 29th in baseball in WAR. They're 28th in ERA. They're 24th in win probability added. And this team, as a result, is 4-9 in one run games, which is the second worst in baseball. And that's the difference between a 500 team and where the Blue Jays are right now. So I think that it's very easy to explain how they got to where they are. It's still early enough in the season. There are enough wildcard spots in play. There are very few teams that I think are like absolute juggernauts. Somebody else who's ahead of them is going to go through a run like they've been on. So they'll have an opportunity to catch up. And I think I'm sort of mystified that they played this way just because of how much talent there is. But, you know, it's definitely time to start ringing the alarm bells, even if it's not time to give up on the season entirely.
Yeah, the alarm bells are ringing here, buddy. They're ringing in a big way. Yeah, they dropped 3 of 4 against the Tigers on the weekend. You know, Ross Atkins had to do a media availability, snuck in on an early morning Saturday of a long weekend the other week. So, yeah, the alarm bells are going off here. We'll see if they can turn it around. I wonder if you see any similarities between where the Blue Jays are and where the Houston Astros are. Astros off to a similarly poor start. The big difference obviously being that the AL West is as a whole off to a bad start. The Mariners, the only team above 500 there. So maybe the Astros have a bit of a better path back, but do you see some similarities there? I guess the other big difference being Kyle Tucker has been like arguably the best player in baseball and the Jays don't quite have that.
I think that, yeah, on one hand, the Astros' path back to contention, just the fact that the Mariners and the Rangers haven't put them away, and I think they'll come to regret not doing that when they had the chance. But you bring up Kyle Tucker, and that's I would say there's a silver lining for the Jays. You know, maybe David Schneider's playing a little over his head, but apart from that, they haven't been bad in spite of, like, you know, an MVP caliber, maybe changes your entire perception of a player's entire potential type of season, which is what Kyle Tucker's been doing. He was a very good player to begin with, and now he's turning into, like, sort of Juan Soto-y. Like, it's really, really incredible. Like, you know, I just having this much room to improve on top of being a multiple time All-Star already, is that just shows you how good he's been this season.
Yeah, and Yordan Alvarez not off to the best of starts here. Alex Bregman, kind of the George Springer in that Astros situation. But yeah, Kyle Tucker's been kind of tippy top there with an OPS over 1,000 and 18 homers already. Been pretty fun to see. Given that Texas and Houston are both a little below 500, Seattle's a little above 500 here. In that AL West, you know, some of the conversation here, Michael, you mentioned the alarm bells going off. You know, fans will text into the show or tweet into the show, hey, shouldn't the Jays be sellers? Like, they're pretty far out of it. They're 5 games out of a wild card already, 12 back of the division. That's probably not going to be the case with Houston and Texas, just given the path back in the West, right?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, they would have to, you know, I was having, you know, conversations about, you know, trying to pick. Texas is definitely not going to sell just because they're built towards 2025. I think there are some players, you know, Bregman being first among them with the Astros, where they'll have to make some tough decisions. And I was, you know, thinking about, where does Bregman fit if they decide to let him go? That would be a really tough emotional decision to make for that front office. But I think as long as the Astros can even make the case that they're in it at the deadline, I think that he's probably staying put.
Okay, let's stay in the AL West for a bit here. The Mariners rescued your fellow name-haver, Mike yes. Bauman, from Seattle, or sorry, from Baltimore. I know you have joked in a piece at FanGraphs that, you know, you have a war on Baltimore now. The wire sucks. You're not eating crab cakes. Before that element of it, though, what is this embarrassment of riches that a guy with a 3.44 ERA and a 3.62 expected ERA is even available for trade on the DFA discard pile anyway?
It's interesting. He's played a very, I would say, an important but unheralded role in the, I mentioned this in the piece last season. He got into a lot of games that were tied or close in the middle innings for a team that didn't really have a great rotation, but had a great offense. And he just kept them in it. He could throw multiple innings and he could keep them in games where, maybe it's like 5-4 in the fifth inning and they just need somebody to get them to that, Yennier Cano, Felix Bautista part of their bullpen. And that's how he ended up winning 10 games last year. And then he didn't make the playoff roster, which, I was in Baltimore for their two home playoff games. He certainly couldn't have been any worse than the guys they actually threw out there. So I think he's just short of being a high leverage reliever, at least the way Baltimore was deploying him. But he's got such interesting tools, really high velocity breaking pitches. And the Mariners are a team that, one, loves fastball slider guys, and two, has built up guys like Andre Munoz, guys like Matt Brash. They've pulled, sort of a different type of pitcher, Paul Sewald and Eric Swanson, but they've been able to develop sort of okay middle relievers into relief ace types. And that's what I'm hoping for with him. In terms of why he's available, he's out of options. And this is just, I'm thinking about writing about this in the near future, because I think this is sort of a recent development that's going to be really important for casual baseball fans to understand going forward, is that there's such a premium on innings and the healthy arms to be able to use to string together 5-6 innings of bullpen, 3-4 days a week sometimes. But the way pitchers are being used, you're seeing guys get called up to the majors and sent immediately right back down, or DFA'd after after one outing. We saw this with Kent Emanuel. There's a couple guys, Mitch White, who well in Toronto, he's on his third team already, and it's not even June 1st. And so guys like that are going to move around a lot more because the roster rules are not quite suited for the way pitchers get used. And just teams have not really figured out different ways to use pitchers other than this sort of, all gas, no breaks type of approach that we've seen with relievers and increasingly starting pitchers. So I think that's going to be a very common thing, is guys with maybe, ERAs in the high threes with, maybe troubling peripherals like Big Mike are going to find themselves moving around, and they'll be able to find consistent big league work, but they'll end up pitching for 5 different teams in 2 years just because of who has a roster spot at any given time.
Oliver Drake changed the game. 5 teams yes. in 1 year back in 2018. In addition to that weird, funky delivery where he like stepped around batters to unleash the weird release point arm angle stuff. But yeah, five teams
also,
in one season.
Also, the
well.
Best accent. Also, the best accent in the 2010s in baseball. Just absolute, you know, Boston Goodwill Hunting parody stuff from Oliver Drake.
He's not that. Maybe this is Mitch White can develop a fake accent here and build on the Oliver Drake knockoff character he's doing here. Let's move the bar here a little bit from these kind of fungible relievers at the end of rosters to one of the top end relievers who you wrote about recently, Emmanuel Clase, who, you know, as people my age, and I think we're roughly the same age, you know, the closer to me is Mariano Rivera. And you think of that cutter that just sawed everyone off. The cutter is kind of gone out of vogue. A lot of guys will lean on the fastball or develop a slider. That's too much of an in-between pitch. But Emmanuel Clase has been able to get to, you know, the kind of the pinnacle of relief pitching right now, leaning heavily on that cutter. What has allowed him to do that? What makes his cutter so special?
Well, I think one, it's extreme velocity, and the cutter is actually starting to swing back into fashion gradually over the past couple of years, but it doesn't matter what pitch is fashionable if your version of that pitch is just so good. And that's what he's able to do. He's able to throw it so much harder. He's able to throw it for strikes. He's able to get movement. One of the things that stuck out to me is, how is he this good with consistently pedestrian strikeout rates? And, you know, the one thing I was able to uncover with the cutter is this was kind of a fine baseball savant search, so I hope I'm getting all the numbers right. He had one of the highest percentages of batted balls in play with a launch angle under zero with his cutter. And out of 1,200 pitch types, individual pitch types, so, you know, Emmanuel Clase's cutter, Emmanuel Clase's slider, Kevin Gausman's splitter, whatever, he was, I think, fourth out of 1,200, and he was the only his cutter was the only pitch in the top 14 that wasn't a sinker. And just the ability to get guys to just pound the ball straight into the ground. And that's why, you know, his exit velocity numbers aren't that great, but it doesn't matter how hard you hit the ball if you hit it straight into the dirt in front of home plate. And that's what he's getting guys to do. He's getting guys to, you know, he's throwing the pitch in the zone less than he did last year, his slider too, and hitters are swinging at both pitches more. You know, I think he's just figured it out. I tried really hard. You know, I made the explicit comparison. You know, there's Mariano Rivera and there's a Kenley Jansen. I tried not to say this is what sort of Gen Z Mariano Rivera looks like, but it is.
Yeah, so shorter outings and heavy velocity and used a little bit less probably. You can't argue with the results. 0.33 ERA, and that's a Guardians team that is doing very, very well, 36-18. I know everyone in the AL Central is kind of overperforming right now. Twins above 500. Royals are 34-21. But the Guardians are at least a team that we expected to be fairly competitive heading into this year. They're not going to finish the year with a .667 winning percentage, I don't think. But generally speaking, are you buying what the Guardians are doing?
Well, I'm buying the lead that they pulled out. You know, to bring this back to, you know, something that, you know, I've been around a lot more. You know, the Phillies, for instance, I did not think that they were better than the Braves. I think even over the course of 4 months, like the opening day Phillies over the opening day Braves, I would take the Braves -7 in that scenario. But they've got that lead, and now the Braves have, you know, their two best players arguably are hurt. So you just have to look at the situation where things are. The thing I like about the Guardians best, well, first of all, they're hitting a lot better than I expected them to. I think that I really have, you know, if I've reevaluated them as a team anywhere, it's there. But also just getting that hot start, getting those, banking those wins. That's the most important thing for the first 2 months of the season. And then you can sort of figure out where you need to adjust, where you need to reevaluate, where you can add, you know, where you can move pieces around. You sort of know what your team is by this point in the season. And if you've got a good sense of where your team is and you've got a head start, I think that matters more than particularly in a race where I think everybody's going to drift back towards the bottom.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, all 162 games are technically equal, right? Like they all count the same. They're all one out of 162. And I think, you know, instinct is that the ones down the stretch really matter the most. But the ones early on here, the ones you can bank, dictate your strategy from here, right? You know, maybe you're the Guardians and you're way more aggressive at the deadline than you would have been otherwise. Maybe you're the Astros and you're less aggressive than you would have been. If you're the Blue Jays, maybe you're a light seller instead of a moderate buyer. So there's definitely something to that. Michael, before we let you go here, I know you're a big college baseball guy as well. The NCAA Division I playoffs get going on Friday. Anything front of mind for you? What should a novice like me look out for other than, hey, who's going to be the top 2-3 picks in this draft?
So I actually was hoping you would ask me that because there is a Canadian who is a star player for one of the best teams in college baseball, Emilian Petre, who is second baseman for the University of Kentucky, which is the number 2 overall seed. They start on Friday at noon Eastern. He's actually, you know, not just to stereotype all French Canadians, the same guy, but there is a lot of Edouard Julien in this game, sort of like the second baseman grinder, really on base at all costs. I really like his game. The single player I'm most interested in is Chase Burns, who's a right-handed pitcher who I saw in person earlier this season for Wake Forest. He's striking out more guys than Paul Skeens did last season, and he's shorter. He's electric. It's hard fastball, hard slider, changeup. He is so excitable on the mound, and he was also a star player at the University of Tennessee last year. So if Wake Forest wins its regional, they will and Tennessee, who's the number 1 overall seed in the country, wins their regional, they're going to face off next weekend in the Super. So everybody in college baseball, all like when the bracket came out yesterday, everybody, Baseball America and D1 was like, oh, look at this. So if that game happens, it will be the game to watch. And the other thing I would say is, if you're one of those people who really bemoans like, oh, we don't get pitcher's duels anymore, you know, we don't get variation in style play, everybody's the same, everybody's just, you know, a series of multi-inning relievers, college baseball is played the way you want baseball to be played. So there's a ton of it. If you can get access to it up there, this weekend is one of my favorite sports watching weekends of the season.
Chase Burns, by the way, projected to go top 3 in this year's draft in July. The Jays don't pick till number 20, but who knows? Maybe
I saw him mock to Colorado. I saw him mock to Colorado. And if that happens, I'm going to burn Coors Field down. Like, he deserves a good landing spot.
So. Yeah, the first good Rockies draft and develop pitcher in forever, he could be. Yeah, that would be, I did see him mock there as well. That could be a tough one. Jays don't pick till 20th, but who knows? Maybe you can fall in love with the prospects. Certainly you can put your rooting interest behind Kentucky and the Canadian second baseman there, Petre. Michael Bauman, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Bauman of Fangraphs, a lot of great work over there. And yeah, I don't know how much appetite there is for college baseball here in Canada or on a Jay show, but it is an interesting time. The draft is around All-Star Weekend in July. It's not quite the same as, you know, other sports, of course, where the draft is so immediate, and the NBA draft, you're looking at, well, how does this guy fit into the rotation and things like that. NHL draft, maybe a guy makes the jump, maybe it's 1 year away. The NFL draft, where it's, you know, the biggest night of the year for 20 teams in the league, but it's still pretty interesting. The Jays have the number 20 pick. That's not going to get you one of the names that's getting ESPN headlines here, but they did pretty well in the teens last year, getting Arjun Namala, who was off to an okay start down in low A ball. He's down in rookie ball. He's on the development list right now. Some of the other guys the Jays have drafted in recent years, stop and start. Brandon Barriera hasn't been able to stay healthy. Landon Moraitis is, you know, still, as far as we know, still awaiting the second opinion results. It sounds like he's potentially headed for surgery there as well. So, and then on the hitter side, it's been a lot of, you know, projectable, quick through the minors, multi-position types. Josh Kosevich, probably the high end of those guys. So yeah, it's interesting. We'll do some coverage of that heading into July, probably not until the college baseball season is over here again, because I don't know how much appetite you guys have for it. And the Jays don't pick until 20, and a baseball draft more than any other draft is pretty wide open. But we'll do some of that stuff. We'll talk to some of our Baseball America pals and make sure you guys are as ready as we can be for the draft in mid-July. So yeah, check out some of that college ball action this weekend. Jays back in action tonight. Kevin Gausman against Mike Clevinger, 7:40 on Sports. That'll be Danjo and Hazel on the call for you. Jamie and Caleb on Blue Jay Central. Ben and Chris on the radio. And Shai is down there writing. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Talk to Mikey Ahedo of Baseball Prospectus. Take a little closer look at Kevin Gausman's season so far. We're going to talk to John Axford, pal of mine, one of the best Canadian relievers of all time. See what he thinks about where the Toronto Blue Jays bullpen is right now. And we'll talk to Lindsay Dunn. We'll do some City Connect stuff, have some fun around Yusei Kikuchi and some of the other lighter stuff around the Jays. Feel like everyone could use a pick-me-up today, and Lindsay's always great for that. We'll also get you ready for Mike Clevenger and what that could look like as the Jays look to keep some offense rolling against the Chicago White Sox down on the south side. All of that is next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, and while he tweeted out a terrific System of a Down reference that Addison Barger would appreciate on his way, and we're playing Mikey Ahedo of Baseball Prospectus in with some Hannah Vu, because Mikey is the only guy I know who works out the softer music than I do. Mikey, good morning, man. What's going on?
How's it going, man? I love the references are always so strong on this show.
It's what I got to do to keep myself entertained over 10 hours a week all summer, talking about a team that's a couple games below 500. So Mikey Ahedo, Baseball Prospectus, all over the place, but primarily Baseball Prospectus. You wrote a great piece last week. We talked about it a little bit as you were doing the research for it. It's called Kevin Gausman is in Trouble. Now, as these things go, when we write, Kevin Gausman immediately came out and had like his best start of the season. We have no data from it other than the strikeout number, because we don't know what the velocity was, the pitch movement, anything like that. So for the sake of this article, let's ignore that last start against the Tigers right now. What was concerning to you about Kevin Gausman's start to the season so far when you wrote that piece?
Yeah, I think it's tough because, a lot of the time it's really hard to look at a pitch, one pitch in isolation, because, pitches don't exist in isolation. And when I look at Gausman, you know, it's really interesting because he's throwing as many fastball strikes as ever. The difference is that his fastball is really getting beat up. And when you look at his splitter, I think one of the really, the things that really stands out, because it's getting chases as much as ever, it's fastball, or it's in zone whiffs are down. I think it's from like 29% to 14%, which is really low. And to me, that signals that there's something wrong with the splitter. What I wrote about is, you know, Gausman, he's a really interesting pitcher because he's as aggressive as anyone with his fastball. And his splitter, you know, I guess you could call it aggressive by throwing it out of the zone, but it's basically he throws his fastball in the zone more than anyone, and he throws his splitter out of the zone pretty much more than anyone. So he's got a really unique approach. You know, as the splitter efficacy goes down, you know, his efficacy really goes down. That's what we've seen. So, just really concerning that the splitter whiffs have gone away, and the fastball, you know, has been more mortal than it's ever been before.
Yeah, and there are a couple things there. And, you know, obviously the first thing we maybe look at with the splitter is, okay, is it getting the same kind of movement, right? Because if the splitter's just hanging a little bit more, it's not getting that same depth, maybe that's a problem. And you did note it's getting a little bit less depth to it. We've even heard Kevin Gausman kind of talk about it. But the most fascinating part of this to me, I think, is that Gausman, and he has a slider, but he's mostly a two-pitch pitcher. Like, nobody is going up against Kevin Gausman and sitting on the slider because you might just not get it. And there's been this interplay over the last couple of years where you have an idea. It's going to be fastball up, and it's going to be splitter down. And that's because those two locations and pitches play really well off of each other. And we've seen some teams who are on the more disciplined end be like, okay, well, anything low, we're just going to stay off then. It's probably going to be a splitter. And then the natural counter for Kevin Gausman then is, well, maybe I'm going to sneak some fastballs in low, steal a couple called strikes low in the zone just to keep guys off balance, and because those stolen strikes are there. So one of the things you pointed out, and part of why Gosman's fastball has maybe been, it's always been hit a little bit hard, but in service of setting up the splitter, it's been hit really hard this year. And some of that is maybe because on average, he's throwing it a lot lower in the zone. What do you think of my theory there that maybe that's not an issue with the rise to the fastball so much as it is he's trying to counter that guys are trying to lay off the splitter low.
Yeah, it's hard to say 100%. I think, you know, there the other thing about all of this is there might be something to just his fastball command, because he's actually, in terms of if you just look at the averages, which, you know, you can get into trouble if you do that, but he's really throwing like he did before he broke out. So, you know, I think that is the... He doesn't have a flat fastball, but I think because of a splitter, he can kind of hide it. The thing that a lot of guys with flat fastballs do is, you know, they throw the high fastball, which gets a lot of whiffs, and then they'll throw the fastball at the bottom of the zone, which, you know, has a really, really unique ability to get hitters to keep their bat on their shoulder. And he's done that for a long time. The thing that is missing, I think, is the whiffs upstairs aren't as common. And then, you know, like we're kind of talking about here is when he's throwing it low, I think, you know, Alex Chamberlain has started to write about this at Fangraphs, and I think someone else at Fangraphs, but there's something to arm angles and really signaling to hitters, like, is this going to be a strike or not? And I think, you know, if I had to guess based on his, when he throws the fastball low, it makes the splitter a little bit less, compelling.
Mm. Yeah, that which would make sense, right? Like, okay, that's the counter. You throw the fastball a little lower, but then it doesn't disguise the splitter as well. That's why historically it's high fastball and low splitter, because those play off of each other well. So one of the other things Kevin Gausman has done, and again, we're this article and this information was before one of his better starts of the season, but even in that 10 strikeout start against the Tigers, he talked about after. He didn't feel like he had his best stuff. He was actually glad the velocity reading wasn't there, so the Tigers maybe couldn't tell that he was down a tick or wasn't throwing as hard. There are a lot of kind of cat and mouse things that Gausman can do to try. He told me a couple weeks ago, you know, you got to kind of make the adjustment before they make the adjustment. Very boxer mentality to it. Kind of set up the adjustment that you want them to make and be ready for it. So one of the things he's done with that is add a two-seam fastball, a sinker that has a little bit of whip back in toward right-handed hitters. Hasn't thrown it a ton, not enough for us to get like a good feel of, is this a good pitch yet, really? But do you like that idea in theory, him adding kind of a second number three pitch as needed there to keep people off balance?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Maybe last year, the year before, I wrote an article essentially called like the Mariners won't stop throwing two seamers, and you know, it's like, I wouldn't say it's like demonized, but over the years with the, you know, four seam fastball revolution, the shine of the two seamer kind of it wasn't there. And I think it's because it's not sexy, you know, like you don't get the whiffs. It's made to run into bats. But I think, you know, especially when you are starting to lose, you know, maybe some of that, it becomes a pitch that, yeah, like you can use to run in on the hands of right-handed hitters and really like get that weak contact. And, you know, theoretically, I think Gausman actually talked about, I think you wrote about, actually has some like two seam action to the splitter. Mm-hmm. So, there's something to tunneling there. So I always think it's a good idea to toy with a two seam fastball for guys. Sometimes, you know, it's like, should you throw one if you have a Garrett Cole fastball? Probably not. But, you know, especially if you're searching for something, I think it's a good idea. And also he's toying with a one seam fastball, which is, kind of in between a one or a two seam and four seam, where it gets kind of the sink of a two seam fastball, but it gets more of the fade of a four seam fastball. So it's, you know, I think catches hitters off guard.
Yeah, certainly. Even just the name can catch you off guard. Let's stick with splitter guys. Yeah, and you mentioned writing about Seattle. You're a Mariners guy, so a lot of Seattle stuff, and we've brought you on to talk Seattle stuff before. What have you made of Eric Swanson's struggles to start this season? With the splitter, it's a lot of location issue, but this is a guy who 2 years ago was absolutely lights out for the Mariners, was lights out for the Blue Jays last year, rather. This one's caught me by surprise.
Yeah, I think Swanson's actually a really good example of a pitcher that, you know, I guess similar to Gausman in a way. He throws a really, really high you know, high slot fastball. And I think what you see with guys like that, they don't, when you throw from that high of a slot, you don't have much room to work with when it comes to the ride that you're creating, the induced vertical break. And so I think really it's a bit of a precarious profile because he's so dependent on the four-seam fastball playing. And, you know, if you just look at the results, for whatever reason, the split finger isn't playing. And I think there's a reason why he's moved away from the splitter, because he's throwing it almost 50% of the time last year and is down to like 36%. So, you know, if I had to guess, it probably has to do with splitter feel, which, you know, I wrote in the Gausman article, like, I think it's overstated how much the feel for splitter goes in and out. But man, Swanee is one of my favorite pitchers. I was really sad that the Mariners, you know, moved on from him, and I was like, okay, we got a good bat in Teoscar, and that didn't work out. But yeah, the 9 ERA and 8 xERA, I wouldn't have guessed this for him. So
no, it's been tough.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Another Seattle to Toronto pipeline guy who's had a ton of success is Yusei Kikuchi, having the best year of his career, probably even better than the all-star season he had with the Mariners, where the second half tapered off there. I know you've been looking at some stuff with, you talk about guys who can just kind of trust their fastball, lefty who throws 96, you know, throwing that in the zone a ton. What have you made of Yusei Kikuchi's strong start the season? I don't want to give anything away too early if you're writing about this, but I do know it's something you've been looking at.
Yeah, I was thinking about it literally yesterday. I don't remember why, but I think I just saw in some leaderboards that he was really shoving, and went to go take a look. Like, why? Because I've written about him multiple times ever since he was with the Mariners. I've probably written about him 3, 4, maybe 5 times. Back in the day, he's throwing a 92 mile per hour cutter. That's really interesting. It got beat up really hard. He's really struggled to throw strikes over his career. And, you know, he's gone from, not striking enough guys out to then walking too many guys for 3 years. And then in 2023, like, kind of figured it out. And this year has, I think, cleaned it up even more so, and now isn't getting hit hard. And I think that's the main thing. But when you look at, just his in zone fastball percentage, like, he went from throwing in the low 50s, or like very low 50s, like literally 50%, to like 61%, which, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think that's probably one of the highest numbers in MLB for starting pitchers. And I just wrote about this with Jordan Hicks. Like, sometimes if you have good stuff, you know, there's kind of the Rays model of catcher sets up middle, you just throw. And when you look at his fastball numbers, he's throwing by far the highest number of fastballs in the heart of the zone, and by far the fewest waste pitches. I don't necessarily think that's command. I think it's more of a control thing, but I think, you know, when you have stuff like Kikuchi, it doesn't necessarily matter. And he's so funny. Like, he changes so much every year. He's always tweaking his stuff. And I think finally he's found a good, you know, combination that works for him, where he's striking out, you know, enough guys, a touch above average, but more importantly, he's not walking too many guys. It's almost half that of the league average. So I love Yusei.
Us too, man. He's been a blast. A bad start on the weekend, but it's been very, very rare. And you mentioned the low walks, lower homers, everything like that. Before I let you go here, Mikey, you mentioned Jordan Hicks. Man, Jays pick him up as a relief pitching addition last year, let him walk in free agency because the Giants are like, yeah, we're going to give him 4 years, $44 million. We're going to turn him back into a starter. Everyone's like, what? Like, this guy doesn't throw strikes at all and throws 100. Yeah. Like, keep him in the bullpen. And here he is with a 2.33 ERA, very good ground ball rate. Still, weirdly, like, not striking a ton of guys out, but having some success as a starter in San Fran. What have you made of Jordan Hicks' quarter season here, third of a season?
Yeah, and I wonder if this is, you know, I was thinking about this recently, but a bit of a trend where guys are kind of starting to move away from the strikeouts and really actually just leaning into the weak contact, which I would welcome. This might be a little bit of a hot take, but I think a lot of the, like, I think baseball was better in like the 2000s and 90s, but I digress. It's really fascinating because Jordan Hicks historically has just been a guy that throws his sinker as hard as he can and guys can't really hit it, but he also can't really control it. And when he signed, I think I was making fun of the Giants on Twitter and just saying, you know, what hubris they have to think that they can sign this guy who is the worst strike thrower of his, you know, in his time in MLB, to a 4-year contract. And of course he is throwing a ton of strikes now. From 2018 to 2023, he went from being about average by zone percentage and 14th percentile in strike percentage to 70th percentile in strike percentage and 89th percentile in zone percentage. So really is just taking his sinker, which is, you know, he's not throwing it as hard, but it's a really hard, good pitch, and just throwing it over the center of the plate and daring hitters to hit it. And I think what really makes it interesting is the hardest pitches to do something with in MLB are the splitter and the sweeper. And Jordan Hicks, his repertoire is a sinker that hitters can't hit hard, and a splitter and a sweeper. So it's just this really fascinating approach of, I'm going to throw my sinker out over the plate. You're not going to do anything with it. And you're going to, you know, you're either going to swing and miss at my sweeper and splitter, or you're going to hit it, you know, you're going to roll over to second base or pop it up. So just this, like, it's almost annoying how the Giants, you know, can do this with a guy who I had no faith in to throw strikes and just, you know, get him to do it. So I don't know if it's a mindset thing or if the catcher's, again, just setting up middle, but he's found a way to just get it over the plate.
Trust your stuff if it's good stuff. Man, Jordan Hicks would look good in the Blue Jays bullpen right now. Mikey Ahedo of Baseball Prospectus, thanks so much for taking the time out, buddy. Enjoy the Kevin Gausman start tonight.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Mikey Ahedo of Baseball Prospectus, a lot of great work over there. And yeah, Jordan Hicks would look good in the Blue Jays bullpen right now, but he wanted the start. And that's part of why he went to San Francisco. They also gave him 4 years and $44 million, which I don't think the Jays were keen to do if they didn't see him as a starter. But nice start for Jordan Hicks. We have a question in the text line. We're setting up John Axford here. And the question came from yesterday from Ed in Aurelia. When you have a high velocity fastball like Jordan Romano does, why fall in love with the slider? It's an interesting question because Romano's always been a two-pitch guy, fastball slider, and that's gone from, you know, at its peak, he threw that like 65-35 fastball slider, and then last year it had kind of gone the other way, like 55-45 slider fastball. Part of the answer to this is when you're a two-pitch pitcher, you're just going to be a little random. You're going to mix it up. You're going to be judging the swings of the batters or the takes from the batters, and that's on Romano and the catcher to figure out in real time. Some of it is also, you know, there is probably a limit to how often he could throw the slider or a limit to how often he could throw the fastball and have them still be the same level of effectiveness because they need each other. They need to play off of each other. A batter has to be ready for both, and they're such different pitches that you have to have them protecting against both. The third part of this is, yes, the slider has been hit harder this year than the fastball has, but he is getting no swing and miss with the fastball so far this year. So I wonder if the situations he's pitched in where he's trying to make a swing and miss pitch, he's just trusted the slider a little bit more. That slider, while it's been hit hard, about 40% of the swings on it are swing and miss, whereas that's single digits with the fastball. So maybe it's a case where right this second, he's trusting the fastball a little bit more for weak contact, the slider in swing and miss situations. Last year, they both had, you know, honestly, remarkably similar results in terms of batted ball and swing and miss stuff. So he can probably get back to that here as well. We'll see what he comes out with next time. This has always been a question about Romano. It's always been a question about two-pitch pitchers. Anyway, Brian in Etobicoke the other day had also asked if I trust Romano as much as I did last season. We'll see. Certainly right now he's having the worst season he's had. It's tough as a two-pitch pitcher. It's tough as a guy who got a late start to the season. Let's see what one of the greatest Canadian relief pitchers of all time thinks about another one of the greatest Canadian relief pitchers of all time, Jordan Romano. It's John Axford, former MLB pitcher, second most saves all time by a Canadian pitcher. How we doing, buddy?
Doing well. How about yourself?
I'm good, man. I thought maybe we'd get a shot of the garage gym here. You've gone for the classier look. What were we lifting to today? What was the soundtrack?
It was actually you. I didn't get out of there Gross. Long ago. So I was listening to your voice and your interviews. That was the garage gym soundtrack this morning.
That is not exactly the testosterone boost that we need. I'm curious. I do want to talk to you about the Jays bullpen, but out of curiosity, like, you are not that long retired. You pitched in the World Baseball Classic last year. You're still, you know, staying active and being a gym guy and stuff like that. How much is still similar to what you did as a pitcher versus now you don't have to worry about throwing? You could just kind of, you know, take the brakes off, take the training wheel, or not training wheel, but the safety rails off.
Yeah, I mean, I think the workouts are still pretty similar. It's more of the preparation or lack thereof, I guess I should say. Before, you know, when playing, it's like, it's hours out of your day. It'd be 5 or 6 hours of, you know, stretching, training, throwing, working out, conditioning, things like that. Now I just go downstairs and maybe I foam roll a little bit and then I start working out and then I, you know, then I'm done. And then I wonder why I'm stiff later because, oh yeah, I forgot the hours of stretching and conditioning and other things that I used to do.
So. Yeah. But you got your kids' teams to coach. You got Jay's games to watch. You got a busy schedule, man.
Yeah, you know, getting down in a squat to catch some 12 and 13 year olds sometimes really tests the back and the knees, but you know, that's why I got to keep moving.
Yeah, you got to do it. That's why you're you know, youth coach of the year here. Okay, let's talk Toronto Blue Jays baseball. I know you stay pretty on top of this team at games with your sons and stuff like that. Have you been on a team that seems to be going the way the Blue Jays have, which is, you know, high expectations heading into the season, pressure season, you have talent but you just can't seem to get out of first gear?
Yeah, you know, the team I can think back to really is probably the 2012 Brewers. You know, we had the great team in 2011. Yes, we lost, you know, Prince Fielder that offseason, but signed Ramos Ramirez and still had most of the core group of guys back, bullpen, starting pitchers, all that. And we just, for whatever reason, I know I was a part of that too. I know I was blowing saves. We were losing close games. And those things didn't really happen in 2011. But, you know, we just couldn't quite break out of it. And then even at All-Star break, we ended up being sellers and a few guys were traded. And then we started playing well again. We were only a few games out of it. You know, eventually, I think we ended up in third place and, you know, didn't make the playoffs. But it almost seemed like at the All-Star break when we gave up, you know, when you start trading guys away, we kicked into the gear then and we're like, why didn't we do this earlier? Why didn't we go on a run then, you know, in May or June? And now we're doing it in July and August for some reason. So, you just want to make sure that those things are done earlier. So, you know, you're not sellers and you're not worried about, how the team's doing. And, you know, you're not having conversations about why can't you get it into gear?
Yeah. And look, that Brewers team started 24 and 29 as well, exactly where the Jays are. Yeah. You guys went 9 games over .500 from there, but the same fear that Jays fans have here, other than the selling component, is probably, well, what if it's not enough? What if you do turn it around and the hole's too big now? How do you, in that room, you know, obviously it didn't go the way you guys wanted there, but you did start playing better baseball. How do you kind of keep everyone, you know, hands on the rope, kind of sticking together and not let losses like Sunday, weekends like this past weekend, snowball on you a little bit?
Some of that, I mean, is definitely relying on the players themselves, you know, them talking, keeping dialogue open, holding each other accountable in the clubhouse. And a lot of that is through leadership as well with your coaching staff. So, you know, we had good coaches. Ron Renneke, our manager, you know, he hosted meetings quite often and we would try and keep things light and try and keep things moving. And really, you know, get a lot of things out there, especially, you know, if something was bothersome to somebody or, you know, something may have been going on within the clubhouse, we would address it as quickly and as fast as you could. But that's really it. Like you just kind of got to leave it to the players a lot of the time. And if you have good leadership, you know, ahead of that, that's where it's going to make the turn.
So in terms of the Jays bullpen, they are going through it together. Jimmy Garcia has been awesome. Trevor Richards has been pretty solid. Everyone else kind of, you know, if not a career worst year, pretty close to it. The Jays as a group, 30th in home runs allowed as a bullpen, home run per fly ball, hard hit rate, all that, 28th in ERA. I would imagine that's, you know, the part of all this that you know best. Can there be kind of like a cascading effect in the bullpen if like a couple guys are struggling, like you feel that as a group? Or is this just kind of an unfortunate sequence of individual struggles?
A little bit of both. I think the cascading piece, like you just mentioned, is definitely a big part. Sometimes when someone's going through it, there's a lot of guys going through it, and that becomes tough. And if you have one guy that's, you know, going well, like you're saying, like Jimmy Garcia is doing great, but if that's the only component that you have currently, and guys are going to try and, you know, surround themselves around him and feed off of that energy and maybe get some of that good feel back. But it's the same when the bullpen's doing well, right? Like sometimes when things are really going well and you're shutting games down, that becomes the cascading effect. So you just got to make sure, you know, you can stop that if it's going in the wrong direction as quickly as possible. And some of that is just the camaraderie that you have in that bullpen. Like those guys are so close all the time. You know, I know through my years of playing, it was, those are the closest guys that I had, you know, on the team. You're spending so much time with them down in the bullpen. You're chatting pretty much all game with them until you're mentally preparing and physically preparing to go into the game. So as long as things are tight there, as long as those guys are keeping things together and not, you know, kind of not falling apart, I guess, things should be able to come back to, you know, righting the ship, I guess.
With respect to Jordan Romano, he has not been the worst pitcher in that bullpen, but he's the closer. So obviously a lot of eyes on him, and he does have a 6.39 ERA right now, which is the worst he had since he first came up. He's only blown one save because a lot of the damage has come in tied game scenarios. I guess first, do you put much stock into a guy who has a couple year track record now of, yeah, he pitches worse in tie game scenario, save situation, he's locked in, tied scenarios, he maybe doesn't perform as well. And I guess just more generally, what have you seen from Romano so far this year versus prior years?
Yeah, I think that's a big thing too. I remember people would talk about that with me, you know, save situations versus non-save situations. But if you're not getting save situations, you got to get in the game, you got to pitch. And sometimes that mentality, you're so used to preparing yourself a particular way in the bullpen, knowing that you're going to go out there in the eighth or the ninth or extra innings to close out that game. And we all know how intense Jordan is when he's out there on the mound. That takes a lot of work. Like you have to prepare that day in, day out to get into that mentality. And sometimes if the game isn't on the line and you're down by 7 runs, but you need to get an inning in, or you're up by 6, it becomes slightly different. And to be able to put yourself in that space every single day and every single game, it becomes difficult, especially if it's not a safe situation. But that's where, you know, guys are really separated. That's where, you know, guys at back ends of bullpens can really get the job done. You know, obviously Jordan started with an injury this year. So that's, you know, kind of set things off a little bit, I'm sure. But overall, I mean, just looking to his last game, yeah, it's like mid 6 ERA or something like that right now. I was just explaining this to somebody. I was like, I just don't like that the intentional walk is an earned run for a reliever. I was like, you know, you're intentionally walking this guy because the guy on third is the winning run. The other guys don't matter. Next thing you know, you're tacked for 3. And you're like, oh, well, that's no good. I came into this game with a 4.5 ERA. I should have been leaving it with, you know, a 4.3 or something if I just get one more out. And even in that game too, you know, not to point fingers in any direction, but that last batter, I think, also should have been an 0-2 count. We were at bat. It ended up being 1-1, then 2-1, and then he gave one back, and it ended up being 2-2. But a 2-2 count giving one back is a lot different than Jordan at 0-2. He has more pitches to work with then, especially with that slider and that elevated fastball. So, you know, looking at some of those numbers, you know, his walks are still low. He's still throwing strikes. He's getting those first pitch strikes in. Just not striking out as many guys, more contact. So I think some of those things will get figured out. He's got a great pitching coach. You know, Pete Walker, I think, is one of the best. So some of those conversations will happen. And I don't think it's going to be too big of a deep dive for him. But as a reliever, you know, you give up 3 runs, that hurts the ERA. It's just some of those other little pieces, those little hits and, you know, not getting as many strikeouts as he has in the past. That's probably where they're going to try and figure some things out.
So you were a guy that had a very good fastball, but you also threw 4 pitches, and that's a little more rare for a reliever. Now we see Jimmy Garcia do it. But when we're trying to diagnose Romano, it's fastball slider. When we're trying to diagnose Eric Swanson, it's fastball splitter with the odd third pitch mixed in. Right. Tim Mesa, 2 pitches again. How does that, like, if you were in a stretch where you were struggling a little bit, could you go away from a pitch that wasn't working for you and focus on something else in a way that maybe some of these two pitch guys, you know, you don't have a choice if you're Eric Swanson, but to throw that splitter in until you figure it out?
Yeah, I think later in my career, I ended up using four pitches. Earlier, as I was mostly closing, it was the three, but I actually ended up with an issue with my slider after 2011, 2012. Going into 2013, it just started morphing into kind of my curveball. I was holding them similarly. The grip felt weird. I started throwing it slower. It just ended up being this loopy thing. And I ended up scrapping it when I was traded to the Cardinals. And it was because I'd throw it in warmups and Yachty would come out to me and be like, "Hey, that looks like garbage today. I'm just going to throw a fastball curveball." And I was like, "Okay, that sounds good." So sometimes, yeah, I would just scrap it just for the sake of it and just so you could feel something and make sure, you know, if it's the fastball extension, then maybe I'm just working on the slider portion, or that slowly morphed into a cutter after I lost that grip. But, you know, in games, trying to figure those things out, that becomes tough. That becomes difficult. If you're struggling like I would with, you know, walks and not getting my pitches over the plate, that's where it would kind of cut back on maybe trying to figure out, let's just do two pitches. Let's feel what this feels like. Let's just work fastball, you know, four seam high, low off the curveball. But in games, you know, sometimes those efforts that you want to try and work on something aren't going to work out in your favor, because there's going to be a moment where you have to throw another pitch, or you have to throw something that you're maybe not comfortable with because you've been only working on a couple things. But that's kind of the space that you get yourself in when you're in these moments. It's, you just got to work through it and hope to come out on the other side.
And look, if you had four good pitches working all the time, you'd probably be a starter. That's what happened to you in 2018 for one game before the Blue Jays, before the Blue Jays traded you away. Last question for you before I let you go here, Ax. And this is from Jennifer Rolnick, who's behind the glass with us here. She just sent me your tweet about eating Fun Dip in the bullpen. She didn't ask a question, but I assume she would like a little bit more detail on the Fun Dip and just generally, like, if you knew you were down for a day in the bullpen, you'd pitch the last 2 days or something like that. Like, how much, especially a guy like you, but how nonsensical is it back there in kind of the lighter, more carefree parts of the game?
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, little games that guys will play down there. Sometimes, you know, there used to always be candy bags. You'd have seeds, gum. If I knew I was down, like, there's been times where, yeah, I was literally eating Fun Dip, and I guess I got caught on TV. I was even pouring it into, like, I think a sugar-free Red Bull at the time, which doesn't make any sense, just putting
sugar in a sugar-free drink.
Sugar-free drink. Sometimes it would be, you know, they used to have the double bubble gum balls, and there would be like eight different colors. And I remember in the bullpen with the Brewers early in games, we would try and guess the colors of the gum ball just based on the smell. You know, you just put the ball in your hand and smell it and be like, okay, that's a pink bubble gum, I'm pretty sure. And open your hand, everyone would be really excited if you got it right. You know, there's seed flicking games. You got to kind of unwind a little bit, because by the time the fourth or the fifth comes around, everyone stops. Like, you almost stop talking. Guys just are locked in mentally and they start stretching and start focusing. So you got to alleviate some of that tension that you're going to be putting yourself into later. And it tends to come with, you know, I guess packets of Fun Dip sometimes.
Can't wait for the 2024 Blue Jays World Series DVD, where everything turns when the bullpen starts getting into the Fun Dip and suddenly everyone's electric back there.
I'll send some packets.
There you go. John Axford, former MLB pitcher, all around good guy. Thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy.
You bet. Appreciate it.
John Axford, second all-time in saves by a Canadian pitcher. Jordan Romano not too far behind him, but Axford has a record he didn't realize he had until the Jays tweeted out that Romano was the second fastest Canadian to 100 saves. John Axford, first. We're going to take a break. We're going to keep it light for this last day. We're going to have some fun. We're going to bring in Lindsay Dunn of City News TO, get to know some of the Blue Jays a little bit better at a personal level through some of the video shorts she's done with them throughout the season. We'll also get you ready for Mike Clevinger against Kevin Gausman as the Jays look to at least lock in a series win and hopefully take the next step onto a sweep of the White Sox as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays back in action, 7:40 tonight. Kevin Gausman against Mike Clevenger. That's a little Dolly Parton to play us back for our next guest of City News TO. It's our absolute favorite. It's Lindsay Dunn. How are we doing, Lindsay?
I'm great. I love a little Dolly in the morning. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
No one's ever working 9 to 5, so I'm here for this.
Yeah, certainly not me. 10 to 12, and then again, whenever the game is on, and then, yeah, you know how it goes. You work like 7 jobs at a time. You're like bouncing. I think you bounce Raptors, Jays as much as I do, but you also have the Leafs, and then you were doing red carpet stuff for Mad Max Furiosa. How was that, by the way?
Thank you for saying that. Insider joke is that for the life of me, I could not pronounce the name of that movie, and I'm not going to even try it now. So I'm like, Blake, how do I say it? Blake, how do I say it? The red carpet was fun. The movie is going to give me nightmares. If you like that kind of stuff, go watch it. The sound, the visuals was fantastic, but that was definitely a little bit out of my wheelhouse because I prefer like rom-coms or Little Giants is my go-to movie.
There you go. I'm a rom-com guy too. I have not seen any of the Mad Max movies, but I do know how to say Furiosa, so that's good. Lindsay, you were down in Detroit for a chunk of this series. You got to see the Detroit City Connect jerseys, which I get what they were going for, but it does look like they got driven over by a truck with the tread marks down the center. What'd you make of those? What are we expecting Friday when the Jays, or I guess Thursday night, the Jays will unveil their City Connects?
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad you're bringing this up because I know there's nothing more that you want to talk about than what is the Jay City Connect jerseys, because the amount of people peppering me in the last week alone about questions of this has been so intense. And in Detroit, probably 60% of the people that I either interviewed or I spoke to that were Jays fans asked me, can you please tell me what the City Connect jerseys look like? What color are they? And my favorite thing about this all is I got offered Canadian money. I got offered a beer, which is like $40 Canadian there, but also a Tim Hortons gift card that had $7.12 on it. And I consider taking that to tell them that I know absolutely nothing about it. The excitement surrounding these jerseys, I don't know if this makes me like a bad person or a bad baseball person, but I don't care until I see the players actually wearing it and how they feel about it, because they're the ones that have to wear it. We can choose to buy it or not, but I purposefully wore purple today because I know there's this thing going around. Is it going to have purple in it? Like, Blake, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so look, there was a version of the alleged City Connects that leaked. I got told by someone who should know that those are not legitimate, but I don't know if that is like, I don't know if I'm getting worked here so that they can keep the air of mystery up. If, you know, sometimes I always wonder if like, this is my wrestling brain. Like, did they leak something to see what the public opinion would be ahead of time? But if you have looked closely, there have been Toronto Blue Jays batters wearing batting gloves with this kind of lilac purple. There have been cleats that are this kind of lilac purple. Jose Berríos and Kevin Kiermaier. Kirk is the one who had the batting gloves. Avery of Gate 14 has pointed this out a couple of times. In the teaser videos, the CN Tower is always a light purple color. I don't know. It would be a very weird, I was going to say red herring, purple herring, I guess, if there wasn't a little bit of purple in these jerseys. I guess we'll find out Thursday night, but it would be, I will have to get to the bottom of why everyone has tried to swerve us with light purple if there's no light purple in the jersey.
Oh, I can't wait for the Sherlock Holmes investigating by you about why was there no purple in it. I'm excited for it to come out because we know half the people are going to love it, half are going to hate it, and it's just going to divide people. But hey, I'm here for it. It's something exciting and has them talking about, you know, other things than pitching or offense or whatever it may be. So hey, let's keep up this City Connect jersey conversation. Yes. But I should have taken the gift card and then just made up something.
Yeah, maybe that's going to be part of the jersey. I mean, the home run jacket has everything else on it. Why not a $7.21 Tim Hortons gift card? But okay, so look, the jerseys are going to be divisive. The Blue Jay, who is probably least divisive of any Blue Jays, Yusei Kikuchi. I know you had a lot of fun with him last week ahead of Yusei Kikuchi bobblehead day. His son Leo threw out the first pitch. And you got, I don't know if this was a scoop. I had certainly never heard it before. I did not realize the Kikuchi-Vogelbach friendship went as deep as you laid it out.
Yeah, I had no idea either. The bad thing about me in this job is I'm very gullible. So I don't know if sometimes people are saying things to just get me to go ask the player and look like a complete idiot and get egg on my face, which is the worst insult because I hate eggs. That would be terrible. So I went right up to Vogie and I was like, hey, I heard from somebody that Kikuchi actually named his kid after you. He's like, yeah, no, that's true. I'm like, what? And so I'm like, I'm sorry, I have to put a mic in your face and I need you to answer this. And he says, yeah, when they, you know, met back in Seattle, neither of them knew each other's language and they got this friendship that really developed. And then eventually Kikuchi and them, like, it just was such a bond that he said, I'm going to name my kid after you. And Vogie was like, yeah, I didn't think it was going to happen. But then he goes and names his kid Leo Daniel Kikuchi. And he says, it's such an honor, but talked about how close their friendship is. But man, his kid is, or Kikuchi's kid's named after Vogie. I never thought that that would be true, and just an adorable kid full of joy. And you could also see that the relationship between Vogie and Kikuchi's kid, that also is a strong bond. So it was something I didn't know was a thing, but apparently, yeah, they're the best of pals. And it was a fun little tidbit. I learned about a lot about Kikuchi on that day that I didn't know before, to be honest.
Yeah, there was a lot. I mean, also we saw it there for the audience that is watching on TV, a great first pitch from Leo, Yusei Kikuchi's son as well. And then there was the, when you ask Kikuchi about which guy's first in line for the premium Japanese whiskey after the Jays win, he's like, obviously Vogie. One other note from that interview, shout out to Derek Brandeo, technical producer. So Lance Kennedy is my technical producer now, and Jennifer Rolnick. But 2 seasons ago on Jays Talk Plus, which was Yusei Kikuchi's first season with the Blue Jays, I'm pretty sure Derek Brandeo was the one who started the Lisa Loeb You Say, because I queue up the music very specifically for the show and I had him play it one day and then he used it as a drop. I'm giving Derek credit for a drop that, and people have asked sometimes, does You Say like that stuff? He told you he loves the Lisa Loeb drop.
Yeah, he loves it. And then for people who don't know, obviously his name is pronounced You Say in the Lisa Loeb song. She sings the word like Y-O-U and then S-A-Y. So You Say. And he says he loves it. It's actually one of his favorite moments from the game because you just strike somebody out. And yeah, it's been playing around him for years. But I'm going to give shout out to you guys as well because you probably started it all. But there's a lot of things that I, because it was like his first Canadian English TV interview. And I realized a lot of his humor is a little bit lost in translation. He's got such a dry sense of humor. I found out he's learning to play the saxophone. And he jokingly said like he wants to play it in front of Manoa if he's ever sleeping to wake him up. And then there's two questions if I can like take over for a moment.
Absolutely.
Okay. Out of that interview, people are like, hey, following up about it, he reads over 100 books a year. So besides learning saxophone, he hosts, you know, some sushi parties with his teammates, which he was making a bit of a joke. We didn't air this about the whole Otani thing. Like, it was so funny. But I said, like, what are the books that you're reading? And he says he reads a lot of North American bestsellers that he gets translated to Japanese. Okay. He reads nutrition books. He reads psychology books, biographies, and a lot about baseball. So I thought like that was interesting, but that's pretty much what fills out his sometimes 200 books a year that he reads. And then something I didn't air is there was that viral story last year about how he gets 14 hours of sleep before he pitches. I was like, are you just pulling our legs? Like, what's going on? Is this for real? He's like, yeah, I get 10 to 14 hours before I pitch because, and he's serious about this, because if he gets less, then he just thinks about baseball too much. So it's also kind of not only a physical thing, but a mental thing that then he's not, you know, spinning the tires about, you know, how is he going to pitch this way? What's he going to do? And then the fluffy part about of all, I didn't have time to air this, and I wanted to make sure that this wasn't a fake story. Like, this is actually shows how genuinely lovely he is. He is building a state-of-the-art, indoor, multi-purpose, like, baseball facility in his hometown in Japan. They just started to do construction on it, and I asked him, like, why did you want to do it? Because we know people have money. They don't have to do anything with it. They don't have to build or give money to the community. And he says, because in winter there's so much snow, there's not a lot of opportunities for people to play baseball. And for those that want to chase their dreams, I want to be a part of it. And I want them to help get to their dreams. And thankfully we turned my mic off because I wanted to go, aw, like what a wonderful human. He's building the state of the art baseball facility in his hometown, but he is funny.
Yeah, that's fun. And for anyone who doesn't know, he's from a town called Morioka in the Iwate Prefecture, which is also, if you are a like late 90s WWF fan, Taka Michinoku is from the same place. I know that won't mean anything to you, Lindsay, but it's the only other thing I know about that hometown. That's very nice about Yusei Kikuchi. A lot of these video hits you do are a lot of fun, but sometimes there's also some trash talk in there. And Chris Bassitt, ahead of Hound on the Mound Bobblehead Day, was giving you some good trash talk. I don't necessarily need to know if Chris Bassitt can beat the other Toronto Blue Jays at basketball. I'll take his word for it. But do you think he could hang in the Raptors media game that you and I coached against each other in? Like, are we taking him with a top pick if we run that back?
You know, given my track record in this media game of going 1-0 and beating you, I would take my opinion on this a little bit more serious. Is, yeah, he was all state. He can still hoop. I would absolutely take him probably as my first pick, and I think he would dunk all over Samson. I think it would be phenomenal, and his trash talk game alone would get in other people's heads. But no, he can still hoop, and I thought that was really interesting to find out that he said, you know, they have this kind of ongoing bet that if the Jays get to where they want to go, I'm not going to say it, I don't want to jinx it, and I also don't want to start a whole conversation online, is that they're going to play some pickup basketball. And he says it's not going to be pretty for the other people if you've missed it, especially his fellow starting pitcher and Kevin Gausman. But I think that he could absolutely hoop with the Raptors media. I think he would break ankles, and I think he would be just in people's faces. I think he would do a Luka Doncic game-winning three roaring in somebody's face. Like, that's the confidence I have in his hoop skills.
Yeah, he's also 6'5", which is much bigger than most of the media that covers the team. Something for him to watch out for. I don't know if this is still the case as he comes back from ankle injury, but Joey Votto told me a couple years that he could still throw down. Like, Joey Votto dunks as well and plays a lot of ball, so we could have a pretty competitive game here. Okay, favorite giveaway so far this year, or that we have coming up for the Blue Jays? I know you do a lot of these when it's like, okay, Kikuchi bobblehead day is coming up, Bassitt Hound Dog bobblehead day is coming up. Do you have a favorite from this year, or like a favorite historically?
I'm going to skip your question and go to the last part that you said historically, because I think if you surveyed 100 people, this would be like the It's Always Sunny episode about Family Feud where they surveyed Charlie and he only gave the one answer. Yeah. I almost guarantee nobody else is going to say this, but the Randall with Randall Grichuk is my favorite giveaway of all time. It was like this Ken Barbie. Oh, do people hate on it? But for me, it's my favorite. It was creative. It was different. I don't have it displayed. It's somewhere in storage. But that by far is my favorite Blue Jays giveaway to date. But what about you? Is there one that you're looking for? Or do you also just really hate that one?
It looks so ridiculous. Like, you can't even tell. You have no, it looks like a Jays fan. Like, it's just a doll in a Blue Jays t-shirt with sunglasses. There's no way to know it's Randall Grichuk other than the box. So all time, and I've said this on air before, is the Gustavo Chassin cologne giveaway from back in the day. Probably not like an FDA approved one, but no, can't be any worse for us than doing Looney Dogs every Tuesday and there's like 70,000 glizzies down people's gullets. Like, it can't be that much worse, I don't think.
I also know, I think they gave away a Snuggie once, or I'm making that up. Like, yeah.
No, that happened.
That one is just, I like that they're different because I don't collect bobbleheads. So every time there's something different, whether it be like, you know, that cricket hat, like, I'm pretty much see-through. I have such like light pigmentation. So anytime a hat is given away, I'm like, give this to me so I don't get sunburned today, even with SPF 50 on. But there's been some interesting ones.
The best one for people like us, and we can see your background here where you have a ton of records, the Braves did a Spencer Strider vinyl record giveaway where he curated like a 7-inch. You don't have the Spencer. Wow.
I don't, but I'm just saying I do. Yeah, some Jay's legendary.
Shaker's Rap. Lloyd Mosby, like, is that who that is?
Yes.
Yeah, nice. Like, all right.
Right. That's the best giveaway of all time. They should try to do something like that for the Jays. And I know Bo Bichette can sing.
Yeah.
Kevin Kiermaier says he can sing. So maybe they can put that on there.
Yeah, maybe we can. Maybe we just spin Grateful Dead night. They're doing it for a second year in a row. I know Bowden Francis is a big Deadhead. We can get something going here. Lindsay, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. I did want to talk WNBA stuff, but maybe just like a quick thumbs up and how excited you are about the WNBA team coming here. I know you covered that last week.
WNBA, this is amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Lindsay Dunn, City News TO. Thanks so much. I'll see you at the park this weekend.
Anytime.
Lindsay Dunn of City News TO. The Jays will be back at the park this weekend against the Pittsburgh Pirates. We won't get Paul Skeens and Jared Jones. Hopefully, they're coming back here having swept the Chicago White Sox. They'll try to keep that rolling after a 5-1 win yesterday, tonight, when Kevin Gausman takes on Mike Clevinger. Mike Clevinger, 675. ERA over four starts coming into this one. Big guy that gets some decent extension down the mound. Not a whole lot else to fear in the profile. He does throw six pitches, so kind of Bassett-ish in how he'll mix it up. We're talking about a 93-mile-an-hour fastball, an okay changeup, an okay slider. Nothing the Jays shouldn't be able to continue getting some offense against here. Now, Mike Clevenger is not quite Nick Nastrini, but you should see a guy with a 6.75 ERA on the schedule and think, yeah, we can keep what's been percolating, not quite brewing just yet on the offensive side, rolling a little bit. The Jays do have a lot of experience against Clevenger as well as a team over 67 plate appearances. They've hit 300 against them with a 5.33 slugging. George Springer has a pair of home runs. Danny Jansen's taking them deep. Other way around, Kevin Gausman has had bad results against this crop of White Sox as well. We'll see if Kevin Gausman can keep it rolling from his 10 strikeout performance against the Tigers last week, a performance which he didn't even think he had that great of stuff. But the results were what they were. They were very, very strong. Strong show today. Thanks to producer Amit Mann for lining up a great list of guests. Ben Nicholson-Smith, Michael Bauman, Mikey Ahedo, John Axford, Lindsay Dunn. Thank you to all of them. Thanks to Lance Kennedy and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blair and Barker, 4 to 6. We'll talk to you again tomorrow at 10 a.m.